Hey folks, Rob Wolf here. Super excited to let you know that my new book, Wired to Eat, will be published shortly, just a couple of weeks away, depending on when this podcast goes up. To celebrate that launch, I've put together four really cool bonuses, including a bonus chapter that I wanted in the book, but the publisher thought the book was already too big, and so we're going to slide that in as a bonus for you folks. And we also have an exclusive interview with Dr. William Cromwell, one of the leading cardiovascular disease researchers in the world, and there's a bunch of other material. But here's the thing. If you want to get these bonuses, if you have pre-ordered or you're thinking about pre-ordering Wired to Eat, all of this ends March 21st when the book officially releases. After that, the bonuses all go away. So if you want to check out the specifics on the bonuses and to get a pre-order of Wired to Eat happening, go to robwolf.com/wired-to-eat, and you can get all the details on that. If you happen to be a gym owner or other business owner and you're interested in selling copies of Wired to Eat, you can also pre-order in bulk. Just shoot us an email at hello@robwolf.com. and put bulk order in the subject line, and we will get you all squared away with the details. Thank you guys sincerely for your continued support. Super excited to see what you think about Wired to Eat. Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Today I have two experts on elite athletic training, HRV, allostatic load, and quite a bit of world traveling too. I have Dr. Daniel Pluse, who is also teamed up with Professor Paul Larson. Guys, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks, Rob.
We had a little bit of shenanigans getting the show going, but we're off and running now. Dan, let's start with you. I think I mentioned before we started recording that a lot of folks are interested in kind of career path questions. So, Dan, we'll start with you a little bit. How did you find yourself to be doing what you're doing currently?
I guess it's quite a long career path. So it all started when I was quite young. My passion's always been in endurance sport. I guess my dad's was a very keen triathlete and endurance person, athlete himself. And so I've always had that passion and interest. And he introduced me to the sport of triathlon from a very early age. I think I did my first swim run event when I was just 9 years old. So that kind of just brought forward my passion for competing and for sport. I went through the ranks of the British triathlon team with it, like national junior champion, and went to compete internationally. And then I went to Loughborough University, but mostly I was there mainly because I was more of an athlete. I was on the world class, what was then called the world class program. Funded by the lottery. When basically I was sent there to train with the squad, and I was a very bad student, I have to say, but at least then I was. So I was a very bad student, and I did way more training than academics at the time. But once I finished my degree, I then had the opportunity to do a scholarship, which was another performance center, which was at Leeds. That was a master's based program to do the scholarship, there. And at the time that was when Alistair Brownlee and Jonathan Brownlee, who, you know, they're first and second in the Olympics in Rio in the triathlon, they were just juniors. So that was quite interesting. So I guess I went there more with a coaching aspect rather than, it was a coaching scholarship more than an actual sports science, but there was obviously my master's was in physiology and sports science. So I kind of, did a lot in that. From there, I went to Singapore for 4 years. Firstly, I went there as a triathlon coach, and I was just doing triathlon coaching. Then I moved into actual working for the Singapore Sports Council, working purely in moving away from the coaching and into the more of the sports science role. I did a lot with cycling, rowing, a bit in triathlon. But most importantly, what I did there was I met the prof.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, we did. So, and at the time, Paul was he was just starting it in New Zealand, and we hit it off quite well. And then Prof brought me over to New Zealand to do a PhD with him, and that PhD was in heart rate variability. So I came over, started my PhD, and then within 6 months, I I got pulled into working with the elite New Zealand rowing team. And then I was, and then I did my PhD, finished my PhD and continued to work with the rowing team. And I was there for nearly 7 years. So there you go. That's the whole story. Quite a long one.
It's a good one. I like it. But Paul, how about your background?
Yeah, so it actually resembles Dan's a little bit in the fact that it was started really from my my sport passion and my triathlon passion growing up. So Canadian growing up and into triathlon as a sport in the early days, and doing it to the best of my ability and wanting to be a professional at it. Traveling the world around, Australia, New Zealand, and trying to get onto the world scene in Ironman triathlon, in my early 20s, and then having a challenge living that dream and it not really working out. And meanwhile, I was doing sports science and, at the same time and flunking out of that. So doing better at triathlon than I did at sports science. But I guess having enough failures at the triathlon, I brought that same passion back to my studies, really wanted to learn about it a little bit more. And then I did, found some good professors that pushed me through in my bachelor's and master's at UBC. In Vancouver, and that won me a scholarship out to the University of Queensland in Australia to do my my PhD in interval training out there. I did that for 3 years, and some of my work caught the interest of an institute that was forming and becoming very strong in the world at the time, the Australian Institute of Sport, and I did a lot of work with them, I guess, as a professor in Australia for about nine, I guess it'd be 6 years there. And that work got me my, so that's actually, that's where I met Dan. I was working out at Edith Cowan University and we did an affiliate program up in Singapore. And that's where, the Plues and I kind of met we hit it off. We had those similar interests in triathlon, did some work together and then shortly following meeting the Plues, I got poached by the New Zealand Olympic program, High Performance Sport New Zealand. And when I was charged really with building a sport physiology team that was going to service and support our national athletes in New Zealand. And Dan was the first one that I, first fellow that I really wanted to bring over and build my team. The topic that we picked was probably something we'll talk a little bit more on, and that's heart rate variability. And it was an emerging useful indicator of fatigue at that time, but not really understood how we could use it optimally. But there was lots of promise, and that's kind of where our paths met. Dan came over, I guess, about 7 years ago into New Zealand, I guess we can kind of talk about how our interest in heart rate variability and our learnings ultimately evolved.
I think most people these days are probably reasonably familiar with heart rate variability, but can you guys break down what that is, maybe just a little bit of the history and why it might be informative for someone who's coaching athletes?
Shall I do that, Prof?
Yeah, I think you're the best at that one, mate.
So high variability, what is it? Yeah, like you say, I think it is becoming a more a term that people are getting to know a little bit more. So what it measures is it's a measure of the autonomic nervous system. So autonomic nervous system, it stands for, it kind of is it's your regulatory system that you have no control over. So like if you walk in a room, your pupils will dilate. If you're like things that just happen naturally. But what's important within that is that there's two branches that we're mostly concerned with when it comes to training and stress, and that's the sympathetic branch and the parasympathetic branch. So the parasympathetic branch is kind of like we call rest and digest. It's kind of more of your relaxation side. So like, as we are sat right now, we'll be more predominantly parasympathetic, hopefully. We haven't been exercising or we're not really frightened. We'll have a heightened parasympathetic dominance. However, conversely, if we get stressed or we exercise, the sympathetic side will be activated. And that the sympathetic side is your fight or flight, which is linked to exercise, stress, and all those sorts of things. But where heart rate variability comes in is that HRV is actually, it's a surrogate marker and a measure of what the autonomic nervous system is doing. So even when we're sat here right now, our hearts are not, even if it's 60 beats per minute, it doesn't mean that each gap is 1 second long. It's actually the gap between each beat is changing all the time. So, and that is in essence heart rate variability. So we're looking at the timing of the gap between each heartbeat and how that varies. And then, and where that comes in is that more variation, so greater heart rate variability is linked to more parasympathetic activity, so more of your rest and digest relaxation side, whereas more less heart rate variability, so less variability within the heart rate, is linked to stress and sympathetic activity. And you'll know that if you ever feel when you're exercising, your heart's quite continuous. It's like the beat of a drum. But if you're like that at rest, it's actually not a good thing. It's a sign that you're quite stressed. And lots of the first heart rate variability studies came out in a lot of health, so all-cause mortality and a lot of poor health is linked to people who have lower heart rate variability.
Gotcha.
In a nutshell.
That's a fantastic treatment of that. So, you know, there's clearly some huge health implications here, but, you know, for the hard-charging athlete, you know, particularly in the United States, we have kind of a weird culture in some ways. It's very laudable on the one hand and also kind of ridiculous on the other. Most of the folks that I hang out with do jiu-jitsu and MMA. They're former wrestlers, and there's definitely this sense that if I just work harder, that's going to be how I succeed. And clearly there's some issues with that, and I've actually found HRV to be pretty helpful in showing how folks are just grinding themselves down to a nub. But I mean, really, how does that HRV score help you guys to inform your day-to-day training and even the longer, you know, mesocycles and macrocycles when you're planning out say like a multi-year process?
Yeah, well, I guess you can look at, I mean, this HRV, and you can look at it in two ways. You can look at it on more of a micro level, and you can look at it, as you said, more on a macro level. So on that micro level, there has been some research and some great studies done that that suggest that changing your training based on heart rate variability, it can be more beneficial than just following a normal program. So, for example, you would take your heart rate variability in the morning. If it's abnormal, so in abnormally high or abnormally low, you would change your training accordingly to do maybe a recovery session or a lighter session. But like some of the apps like Heart Rate Variability for Training, for example, that also encompasses some subjective markers at the same time. So you do your heart rate variability, you do your subjective markers, and then it'll give you kind of an acute idea of what you should be doing on that day. But on the other hand, what we found in the work that me and Prof did and Martin Bouchette with our PhD was that we found that we found it to be more beneficial on a macro level, is that the heart rate variability responds differently to the types of training that you're doing, and you should expect it to respond in a certain way. And if it's going in a different way, it means you're probably not adapting that well to the training stimulus, and then you might want to consider changing it. And that's certainly how I would use it within the rowers when I was working with the New Zealand rowing team.
Nice.
So, yeah, and the only thing I'll just add onto that, just to kind of echo some of the things you were saying there, Rob, with you know, your jiu-jitsu athletes and whatnot that are, you know, really training hard all the time. You know, we see that very often across the board within you know, I guess our culture in the Western world. And Phil Mafton and I wrote a paper on this one, Fit but Unhealthy, a Training and Eating Paradigm. You might have seen that, and really we're yeah, we kind of put this model forth where you've got this brain that's motivated by that, you know, that no pain, no gain mentality, and you're always pushing the sympathetic system and the HPA axis. You kind of see this downward spiral in, I guess central nervous system function, or at least the central nervous system more towards that sympathetic branch, all the time. And heart rate variability, nicely picks that up for us. So it can be a nice little, feedback system to let you know you need a little bit, you need to take off some sympathetic stressors in your life, whether that would be, you know, improving your sleep or improving your nutrition or reducing, you know, whether it's life and work stress, etc., and having those kind of come off until it rebounds back.
Gotcha. So how, given the fact that the HRV is really giving us this macro picture of kind of total allostatic load, like the full stress load that we're experiencing, and that kind of interpreted through the relative allocation of, sympathetic versus parasympathetic stimulation, how does that inform your nutritional approach?
Do you want to go, Prof?
I'd say we're actually, we're looking at that now. We've got a few studies that are underway that are going to hopefully get a little bit more insight into that are studies that are comparing, the effect of switching from a traditional higher carb, based diet more towards a keto level diet, and mm-hmm. and how heart rate variability might fluctuate and detect improved health. So we're blood glucose is a classic sympathetic stimulator, right? So I would say if you can get your blood glucose level under control, that's definitely one factor that is going to have an influence on, it's going to be a contributor to improved central nervous system function and by actually taking away some of the sympathetic stress. Phil and I put that into our, fit but unhealthy training and eating paradigm, where on the one side of that figure that we have where, the high glycemic, highly processed, refined foods it produces, more sympathetic stress, more inflammation. So, diet has a real potential. It's a real potential contributor to the central nervous system, and potentially could be picked up by heart rate variability.
Right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because I was just going to give a bit more content. So me, just so the listeners can kind of get an idea of what me and Prof, what we did is that me and Prof, we had real time. We actually looked at real time blood glucose. We're using the Dexcom, and we did real time heart rate variability using the first beat, and we were collecting heart rate variability in the morning. And it's astonishing, just in ourselves at least. Obviously, it's not in the, we can't say this is the same for everyone, but it likely is how the HRV would respond to levels of blood glucose, and how stress would, if you are feeling more stress, how that the blood glucose also would go up. I actually did a presentation, and just before I did the presentation, you could see blood glucose goes up, HRV goes up. Everything's kind of interlinked, which is why, for us is really fascinating as to why, like, the diet really does show how it can help with your general well-being.
That makes a ton of sense. How much have you guys, now it sounds like you're studying this in a pretty rigorous way right now, but I've kind of noticed that oftentimes the thing that gets studied is kind of what the coaches have already been fiddling with, and they've got some ideas about, what they're saying, and then we just want to get a little bit more rigorous about that. Is that kind of where this has come from? Like, what do you guys, or what have you historically done nutritionally based off that HRV score? Like, have you played around much with some of the kind of keto adapted, fat adapted phases? Are you using some targeted carbohydrates at various points? Like, how are you guys slicing and dicing all that?
Yeah, I think definitely that's, you know, I've definitely seen that. So this paper, again, keep going back to it, Fit But Unhealthy, it really stems from our observations in the high performance program in New Zealand, and of course Phil Maftone's observation in hundreds of athletes that he's seen, and you have people that come to you and they are they have these unexplained illnesses that we globally name the overtraining syndrome. And, you know, nutrition is one of those areas that we believe is a large confounder and a large contributor to it, that highly processed, high glycemic, refined food diet. And, you know, it's the first thing that we try to pull away and change, obviously. And we see a change in physiological function. We see a person, an athlete that returns back to health. I guess that's like you said with the coaching, that is, you know, we see that one firsthand. But it's hard to actually form a study, concrete study, where you're going to take 20 overtrained presenting athletes and then run them through a 2-month period of adaptation and measure them. It's easy to say that, but the reality is it's not an easy study to kind of perform. So you're right, Rob, in saying that we see these at the coaching level first. So the big thing that fluctuates with that also is your fat oxidation. So your fat oxidation rates, your ability of your mitochondria to burn more fat relative to carbohydrate is a big rock. It's a big changer, something that's happening behind the scenes.
Right.
Probably controlled by that insulin, of course.
But it all starts for me and Prof, was it just, it's amazing how even we start in ourselves, right? And I'd really encourage people, like, self-experimentation is just the best way to find out and start yourself on a journey of learning. Like, since I've changed, I did a 3:55 for a half Ironman, the fastest time I've ever done whilst I'm working, considering I used to just train full time. And I swear a lot of it is just because I'm a lot healthier. And the diet has really changed the way, it's changed my ability to recover and do things. Like in the athletes that I coach, I've seen massive changes. And that would guess that for me and Prof, when we were working high performance sport in New Zealand, it was a little bit frustrating that we could see like just athletes who like we have a duty of care, I guess, to athletes to be fit and healthy. And I think it is achievable. You don't have to be one or the other. And that's what we need to strive for.
It's Australia and New Zealand are interesting to me because they have a real opportunity to bypass all of the last like 60 years of really goofy nutritional science, nutrition recommendations. But man, it's kind of funny because most of the rest of the world doesn't like the U.S. Healthcare policies, gun laws, healthcare system, but man, they sure like adopting our nutrition, and it's kind of fascinating to me. I'm like, you guys don't like anything else we do, so why are you so enamored with our nutrition? And I've actually been working on kind of an open letter to the health authorities of Australia and New Zealand because it's like, hey, you guys are largely secular. Westernized countries, you don't have, the notion of evolution doesn't give people a rash. And so you guys could really leap like 3 decades ahead of where the U.S. is on this stuff and just bypass a lot of issues. But I still need to write that paper. But what do you guys think about that?
That's for sure. It's just so hard to change, though. It really is like, you know, like that old cognitive dissonance of people, once someone's mindset is, you just won't shift. And you know, sugar tastes good; it makes people happy. Indeed. Why do you want to cut that out?
Right.
That's right.
Butter tastes pretty good too, but it's not the same.
It's not. But you know, they both the the medical profession and nutrition professions, they, you know, the experts get taught a certain thing in school, and why should that change, right? So right. So it's difficult for others on the periphery that maybe been taught something different. Maybe I believe we've been taught how to experiment and learn, and that our opinions and our beliefs and philosophies can change. And when you come across people that don't have that same belief, it's pretty challenging. And that's certainly, I think we may have experienced that a couple times in our time with our former employer.
Right. Guys, are you generally following like a classic nutritional ketosis that would be, you know, straight out of like kind of the Finney and Volokh recommendations? Like what exactly is the approach that you're using is first question, and then maybe we could break this into a second one. But I'm also curious if you are finding this more fat adapted approach more and more appropriate for the longer duration activities. Like I've been fiddling around with lower carb fueling my jujitsu activities, and I eat fewer carbs than most of my contemporaries. But if I dip into that legitimate kind of keto range, 30 to 50 grams of carbs a day, I start kind of falling apart. But if I throw in some targeted carbs before training, I seem to do pretty well with that kind of middle ground. But I'm just curious what you guys are recommending, and then also maybe where the boundaries are, where you see that straight up keto approach working, and then when we need to add in some carbs.
Do you want to go first, Bob?
Sure. For me, I mean, I've got some, I got about five athletes, and three of them are, you know, world class level in terms of Ironman triathlete fellas, and I would say two of them are on a, you know, they'd be on a pure keto diet, and they tolerate their that less than 50 to, you know, less than 50 to 70 grams, kind of in that range. And don't forget they're eating a lot, and they're training 20 plus hours a week. So and they're, you know, they're pulling out some decent high intensity sessions, L4, L5 work, and they're having no issues at all, following about a two month adaptation period. I've got another athlete though that is, you know, he's struggling a little bit, and he needs a, you know, well, we're experimenting right now with a little bit more carb, and we do, I would say, periodize the carbohydrate. Not necessarily with high intensity efforts, but with when performance matters and when the race is on the line, we'll push a little bit more carb in the diet towards those. So that's my general practice. I don't know, you the please?
Yeah, I mean, I think even when me and Prof hang out, we're like always measuring our ketone levels and our blood glucose. I'm like, what are you at? And Prof is always a little bit more ketogenic than me. He's always higher in the ketones. I remember one time his ketones were higher than his blood glucose. He didn't feel
I remember that session.
Yeah. But for me, I am a little bit more whole food, but it really depends on what I'm doing, because at the moment I'm training for Ironman. I've got Taupo Ironman in a few weeks, and I really – if I'm doing 25 hours training a week, I cannot be ketogenic. It just absolutely kills me. So I'm a bit more real, more whole food, and my carbohydrate intake will still be between 100 and 150 grams, which is not ketogenic, but it's still pretty low. But then if I'm not training, I will try and be a bit more ketogenic, and I'll introduce a little bit more intermittent fasting. Because that just helps. I just don't need to eat as much. But when I'm training 25 hours a week, I do need to eat as much. I need to eat a lot more. And then with my athletes, so they are more whole food than ketogenic, but the thing is with endurance, if we were to measure ketones during the day, they would be, for most of the time, they do one fasted session in the morning, or they do a long session without fueling, and they'll be in ketosis, exercise induced ketosis, but that ketosis will then last for the rest of the day. And I even find that in myself, is that I will use the exercise to get me into ketosis, and then it will pretty much hold, but I'll never really wake up in ketosis. And that's the same for the athletes. So I guess that's the difference for me and Prof, and the same as Prof, we will introduce a little bit more carbs 3 to 4 days out of an event, which and then obviously carbs during the event as well.
Gotcha. So I mean, there is still just a huge amount of individual variability on this stuff. Clearly genetic factors, maybe some gut factors influencing all that, and we're just barely starting to peel that onion, I feel like.
It's about finding your own sweet spot, and that's the real key. Everyone's individual, but like, I mean, I've read some nutritionists' advice to athletes in the past, and it's all about, and literally it is about, don't eat that type of bread, not enough carbs. Don't eat that. You can get more carbs this way. It's like getting as many carbs in as you possibly can, which to me is just insane. Like, it's all about finding, literally this, I read this one bit of advice from a nutritionist, and it was all about what things to do and ways to change the eating so he can get in more carbohydrate. It was just insane.
Which, I mean, once you hit like pasta and bread, like how can you not get enough? I mean, that, you know, rice, pasta, bread, noodles, like I could put 1,000 grams of carbohydrate down pretty easily doing that. So would kill me, but I could do it.
Yeah, well, think about most people. I mean, a lot of people will get up, they'll have cereal, a sandwich for lunch, and then some kind of pastry dinner. Like, you know, that's and that was me. Like when I was competing with the national team, I used to just pack in the carbohydrate, and I was actually, and I really struggled to keep my weight at race weight because I had to really restrict what I was eating. Whereas now, I'm never. I'm lighter than I ever have been, and I'm never really that hungry. I just eat when I'm hungry, and I'm much happier. So,
right,
yeah,
right.
And I was the same. I was a 2 liter Coke a day, and I believed, you know, going through university, I believed that I could do that because I was training 20 hours a week, and that was just fine for my body. It was still high carbohydrate, and you know, because I was training that much, that was going to be just fine. Obviously, and like the Plues mentioned as well, where he's getting his fastest times now. I achieved my fastest Ironman sub 10 at age 45. So,
nice.
Yeah, it was a real eye opener for me when I, it seems common sense now. And when I look back at what I was doing, it was just, it's ridiculous, but, you know, you're influenced by those and others around, and, it's time to turn this ship around.
Absolutely. I remember doing some horrible shakes in my powerlifting days where I would take like 4 cups of white rice and a can of tuna and powdered milk and regular milk and blend this all up because it ended up being cheaper than like the gainer fuels you could get at the time. And it was absolutely horrible. And usually within about 20 minutes of consuming this wretched concoction, I was hungry again. And then within 2 hours, I was in like a hypoglycemic shock and spent the first probably 25 years of my life kind of, you know, bouncing in and out of that kind of hypoglycemic event, you know, planning while I was eating one meal, I was planning the next meal because it was almost like an emphysemic with an oxygen bottle. Like I knew I was going to get into trouble if I went too long between eating. And that's another feature of the, you know, that's really appealing to me about that more strict ketogenic level where I could go a day and not eat and I'll be hungry, but I'm totally functional. But even when I'm motoring along with that 100, maybe 120 grams of carbs a day, I have pretty good blood glucose control, but I can still get into some dodgy situations, you know, like I'd still need to eat more often. Like I'm not quite as robust in that regard. What do you guys think about that?
Yeah. Well, are you asking like how is our stability of our, I guess, energy levels and whatnot through the day with ketosis? And fasting and stuff. Yeah. For me, I think I'm kind of like what the Plues said is, I'm pretty, I don't have too much trouble gaining, you know, getting into that, ketogenic state, decent ketone levels, you know, kind of a, when I measured above, typically above one. And I can go through through my day for fairly long periods without eating. So whether it's skipping breakfast and just having a bulletproof coffee or the like, a fatty coffee, and having just having a big huge dinner at the end of the day doesn't affect me too much. But I know I think the Plues might be a little bit different there.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm. Yeah, when I'm training, I'm definitely I do eat more, I guess. I do definitely eat more than Prof, but what I really like is that if I don't have the opportunity to eat, I don't have to eat. And like recently with my new job, I've been traveling quite a lot, and like a lot of the time when you're traveling, it's really difficult to get good food. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be in the position where I don't have to eat if I don't want to eat, and I can wait until I have the, until I get a time where I can actually get some good food, which I think is just it's so powerful and so useful. I don't have to eat the plain food. I can just not eat it and then wait until I'm somewhere where I can actually eat good food. And it gives you that flexibility and that ability. Whereas, a few years ago, I would have been just eating everything because I would have been scared of me not getting another meal for a while.
Right. Nice. Okay. I always like confirmation bias, so that helps a ton. Guys, before we wrap up, I know you both, in addition to the elite side of this performance story, I know you're really passionate about the health and longevity story, and this has been a kind of a trade-off scenario in my head that I've thought about a lot, for probably the last 15 years. But what do you guys do to kind of keep an eye towards that health and longevity axis? Clearly maintaining our metabolic health, muscle mass, immune function seem like, really big considerations. But what are you doing to kind of goose that health and longevity axis?
Sure. So I'll go first on that one. I guess the one that strikes me first and foremost is I've just returned home to Canada, and I'm situated now in a what would be called a blue zone. So, I'm aware of the longevity research that's shown the potential benefits of being in those so-called blue zones, where you're in a small town kind of community feel without without big commutes and whatnot to work, et cetera. So there's no driving. There's, I can walk my daughter to school, down the lane and live in a clean environment. Standard stuff with getting activity and, love my endurance training and, continue to do that. And, just big around family and community. And then obviously the diet stuff. So those would be, I think those would be the big ones. Standard stuff as well in terms of controlling my screen time and just very, very aware of all the different, factors that go in towards longevity and doing my best, that I can to try to stick to those guidelines.
Great. Plues, how about you?
Yeah, from me, I guess one of my Prof's mantras is you can't manage what you don't measure, and that's kind of the approach that we both take to a lot of even the longevity side of things is like, what are the things that matter for longevity? It's, low and stable blood glucose, you can measure that, and we do measure that. Sleep, we measure that, and we do measure that. Stress, heart rate variability, for example, we measure that, and we do measure that. So like for me, if I was going to pick from three big rocks that you can measure to really improve your longevity and know what's going on, that's what I would be measuring. And I think you have to start off firstly with knowing what matters and then measure what matters. And from a longevity standpoint, I think they're really important things. And then, you know, all those things that Prof was talking about then, like, you know, limiting the time in the screen, family time, community, long drives and sat in traffic and stuff like that will be things that you know will stress you out and things that you should try and avoid. And everyone will be slightly different. I was traveling 2 hours in a car to the rowing center for nearly 7 years. And that just, you know, I'm looking back now, I think that was quite a heavy stressor on me. In fact, I read a paper the other day that he was saying that sat in traffic in rush hour is almost as stressful as doing exercise on your sympathetic nervous system. But the problem is you're not getting any.
You're getting no upside. Yeah. Yeah. All downside, yeah. No upside. That doesn't surprise me at all. Reno. Yeah. Where I live, it has one spot where there's some traffic. The rest of the time, it's super easy sailing. But if I find myself in that one spot, I just about lose my mind. And then if I'm in Atlanta or San Diego or something where there's legitimately bad traffic, I'm just like, how do people deal with this? Like, I would shoot myself.
I'm the same. Yeah. I was traveling around Australia last week, and I had the day in Sydney. Oh, my word. I could not wait to get Sorry for those people living in Sydney, but it was just so busy. And but now I'm fortunate that I do a lot of work from home. And when I do work out of home, I'm close to where I work. So the travel time's limited. But, yeah, I just can't be doing with that.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And you've probably got about 80% of your listeners right now, Rob, that are just shaking their head going, why am I in this traffic right now? Because that's what I always did.
I have noticed that since my commute to my office used to be 15 minutes and now it's like four, I don't really get much podcast done anymore far as listening. So,
That was the my 2 hours in the car drive. I did it twice a week. When I was working with rowing was my podcast time, and now I'm just not near as good as I used to be. I definitely need to get into that.
I've been listening to podcasts while I do dishes in the evening after the kids are in bed. Otherwise, I don't prioritize it any other moment. So, yeah, no, it's interesting. But, guys, it's been a huge honor having you on the show. Can you let folks know where they can track you down on the interweb, social media, all that type of stuff?
Go ahead, please.
I'll go first. So we do have our own website that you can track us down, and we're currently revamping that, and there's going to be a lot more exciting things on there, and that's www.plusandprof.com. So that's kind of health, longevity, performance, nutrition, big focus on triathlon, Ironman training and coaching, so look us up on there. On Twitter, you can find me at @theplus1, and and we also have a Facebook page, Plus and Prof, as well.
Cool.
Yeah, and I'm Paul B. Larson at Paul B. Larson on Twitter.
Cool. Well, guys, it's really has been a ton of fun chatting with you. I know we got off to a little bit of a shaky start on all of our side, but it was a phenomenal time having you on. I actually took a ton of notes, and I'm going to start fiddling around with some more of the stuff you talked about. But are you guys going to be out and about at any big events where people can track you down in the next, say, like 2 months?
Not me for 2 months, Rob. I'm hunkered down. Writing my book right now and building stuff with the Plus.
Nice. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah. Apart from Ironman Taupo in a few weeks, I was almost going to an NRL conference, but unfortunately that's the same time as the Ironman Taupo. But I'm always out and about with in the sports sphere. So I will, if anyone follows me on Twitter, I'll always tweet it up and let people know where I'm going.
Awesome. Well, guys, take care and thank you again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Okay, take care. Bye bye.